The unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals 8 p.m. Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, along with an ensemble of gifted hosts. Dr. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder, Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and Dr. Warren Holloman, our master of wellness. These guys are not only gifted hosts, they are also great storytellers. Rounding out our team are our chief production engineer and media director, Nicole Rocherman. I've been learning how to pronounce her name. And our intern, Tatiana Gago. Together with our guest storytellers that we bring on the show every week, we celebrate the power of story. Stories take us on a journey where we begin to experience the world within the storyteller's world. Storytelling is an important means of communication that goes beyond a set of statements. In fact, science shows that the brains of both the storyteller and the listener are in sync during the story and are so connected that the listener anticipates what the storyteller might say next. So, let's do some synchronizing ourselves tonight. I have two guests tonight, Matthew Hefty and Jacob Reiner. Matthew is a veteran, a writer, and a lawyer. He is the author of A Hard and Heavy Thing, a war novel described as being less about bullets than about the complicated inner lives of soldiers. Besides being a writer, Matthew is also an associate counsel with a nonprofit organization that provides quality legal representation to defendants nationwide who have been charged with capital crimes and who could otherwise not afford representation. It is interesting to realize how important the narrative, the story, and its telling are in the trial setting. Jacob Reiner, many of you will recognize, is our former production engineer. And as a former guest, he recently graduated from the University of Houston downtown in communications with an emphasis on public rhetoric. He currently works as a producer for Sports Radio 610 and the Cleverly Food Show. And I know he brings a special touch to the latter because he studied culinary arts. Jacob is also a veteran. In 2016, he told us about how he came to be in the Army and a story about the friendships that come with being deployed. He's going to pick up where he left off and tell us stories about returning to civilian life, along with a very special closer to the show. So, Matthew, welcome. And Jacob, welcome back to the show. Thank you for being here. Okay, Jacob, since you're an old-timer, let's just hear from you for a moment on how you've been doing since you left the show. And don't forget that you really miss us.
I do. I want to say it is great to be back talking to our Hankinites. So I hope y'all enjoy the show tonight. It's a blast. It's kind of weird being on this side of the window and it being a full hour now. When I was doing it, it was 30 minutes on Thursday. So good job to all of y'all to get yourselves on a bigger primetime spot.
Well, thank you. And you had to be a part of that because it was shortly after you left that we graduated. So, Matthew, I know you do quite a bit of public speaking. Have you been on the radio before?
I have a handful of times, but this is going to be, I think, a little bit more frightening, a little bit scarier, because even though I've been on the radio before and even though I do plenty of public speaking, the other times I've been on the radio, it's all been interview and conversation kind of formats, and when that's the case, you know, it's easy to talk from one person to another and to look into another person's eyes and connect to that person. But here, telling a story on the radio, you know, that's something new for me. And it almost feels like, you know, I know that there are people out there, but it's almost like telling the story out to the abyss in a way.
Yes, that is something where if you're used to getting your audience feedback when you tell a story. Okay, to our radio listeners, you are going to hear some stories tonight from life, from war, from returning to civilian life and engaging in new endeavors. Most importantly, these stories will all be from the minds and hearts of our storytellers. Some may be a little bit hard to hear, but I promise you that we will move from the difficult to something that will warm your souls. So, Matthew, let's start with you. I understand that you were deployed twice to Iraq and twice to Afghanistan as an explosive ordnance disposal technician, with three of these tours as team leader. One thing that I've learned from you is that the explosive disposal team is not always defusing a foreign device, but that as an overseas war winds down, you're also responsible for destroying American ordnance. I think that's where your first story starts.
That's right. So it was my fourth combat deployment. It was supposed to be my last combat deployment. At the time, it was supposed to be my easy deployment. EOD troops have taken the largest amount of casualties per capita. The IED has turned into the device that has caused the most casualties. And by this point, I had already been to Iraq, I had already been to Afghanistan, had already done and disabled hundreds of improvised explosive devices, had already sifted through the carnage of dozens of post-blast investigations. And this was the drawdown. And it was supposed to be the easy one. And I had my wife still at home, two young daughters, and had planned on getting out of the military soon after I got back. It was, you know, the downhill turn, if you will. So soon after we got to Iraq, we took over from the previous team, and you always do a right seat, left seat, and that just means that you ride in the right seat while they ride in the left, and they show you the ropes, and then a week later they're gone, and they showed us where our disposal range was, and they showed us where our safe area was for conducting our disposals. And if you didn't know, explosive ordnance disposal is a career field in which when you have hazardous weapons and explosives, often the safest and least expensive way to get rid of them is to detonate them, to blow them up in a controlled manner when you're controlling the terms of the detonation, as opposed to allowing that detonation to occur in an unexpected or irrational way or in a calculated way set out by the enemy. So on a Sunday night, we got a call from the ammunition storage point. They were responsible for storing all the weapons for the Army. They called us and said, "We have these rounds, and we're not sure what they are, but they're coming apart." So we responded on an emergency basis, and we looked at them, and they were these large 155 tank rounds. And the warhead on them was not explosive, but the cartridge itself was coming apart because they had been sitting out in the heat for who knows how many years. This was 2010, and we had been there since 2003. It could have been as many as 7 years. They weren't safe to transport a great distance, but we also had another problem. We were running out of C4 plastic explosives, and that's what we used to get rid of other explosives. It's what we call a donor charge. We put those explosives, the C4, onto whatever explosives we want to get rid of to make them go away, as we said. So that was a problem that we had. But we had a range in the middle of the two runways on Joint Base Balatarok, which was the busiest airway in the theater of operations. But every time we conducted detonations, we would contact the air traffic control tower, and we would shut down flight operations so that we could do our detonations, because it was the only place where there was enough space to actually conduct detonations in a safe manner. And we would retreat to a bunker where we could take cover and detonate the ordnance on our terms. Now, not having C4, we had to come up with something a little bit more creative. And so another team took some rounds out, a select number of them, and tried to get rid of them with detonating cord. And that didn't work. They ended up just blowing propellant all over the range, which led to an entire day out in the hot desert sun picking up propellant pellets for that team. While that team was out there, I was back at the command center, and I was trying to get our hands on more supplies, more explosives, so that we could do a job. And they came back, and they debriefed us, and they told us this detonating cord method isn't going to work, and we have a whole pallet full of these things that we need to get rid of. So we, continued trying to get C4, and we were able to get C4 and secure some additional supply before our regularly scheduled range day, which was typically on a Wednesday. And so it looked like everything was going to go as planned, and we got the supplies we needed, and we went out there for our regularly scheduled day, which was every Wednesday. Now, there was a program every Wednesday in which the base general and the first sergeants would nominate what they called their star performers to come out to the range to help the EOD troops. It's a very labor-intensive operation, and EOD teams are small. So when we had a large number of ordnance, you know, they would help us carrying the heavy stuff, the stuff that was safe to handle. They would take pictures with the explosives. We would give them explosive ordnance training, recognition training, so that they could recognize hazards when they saw them on the battlefield. But mostly it was what they referred to as a morale program. And the idea was that it boosted troops' morale to be able to go out to the EOD range and to see large explosions and get a taste of that combat that they typically weren't seeing that we were. So they would bus every Wednesday a group of about 15 to 20 top performers out to the range. They would help us, and then before we connected the firing train, they would head back to our safe area, to the bunker, and wait for us to hook in, and then we would head back to the bunker. So this particular day, we did everything we were supposed to by the book. We set up our explosive shots. Everybody took pictures. Our commander-in-chief actually came out that day because it was one of our troops' birthdays, and we did push-ups because that was our commander's idea of morale building, was doing doing PT. And we all did push-ups, and we were all having a good time. It was a sunny fall morning, and it hadn't yet gotten too hot because we started early. And everybody went back to the bunker except the EOD team. We connected the initiators to the explosives when we went back up range. And I was the third-ranking guy. I was the team leader. Above me was our range safety officer, and they're in charge of making sure that everything is within our regulations, and they don't actually handle munitions while they're performing that role so that they can keep a big picture view. And then our flight chief was also out there the same day, and he was in charge of both of us. But I was the team leader and was responsible for the actual construction, building, and plugging in of the shots. That also meant that I was responsible for telling each person who was detonating a shot when to go, when to pull that plunger. So we always solicited volunteers to pull that plunger and then gave them the disposable detonator, took it apart so that they could have a keychain out of it. So we took, you know, six volunteers for our six shots. Each one of them could kneel down, and when I told them to go, they could pull the plunger and detonate the shot. So everything was set up, and I looked around. We made sure that we had 360 degrees of clear area, that no aircraft were coming in. We contacted the air traffic control tower. We read the safety briefing straight out of the book, checked everything off on the list, and we yelled fire in the hole three times, and then I told the first person to pull. So they pulled, and the first shot detonated, and I listened. Always wait a beat, just in case you hear fragmentation coming, because you see the blast before you hear it. And then, when everything seemed normal, then I said, okay, number two, go. And that's when I saw something flutter underneath my armpit. I had my back to the blast, and I was standing between the blast and our volunteers. And something fluttered under my armpit, and then the airman who was kneeling on the ground in front of me, who had volunteered, his chest essentially exploded in front of me. And without even thinking, I dug my hands forward, trying to stop the bleeding before I could even think, and my hands just went right through his chest. And I knew that there was no chance for him, and that he was already dead, but I heard a screaming, and it was the soldier who was right next to him, and his leg was spurting blood, and his arm was just dangling there. So I whipped off my belt and used it as a tourniquet, and my range safety officer, my day mate, he whipped off his belt and used it as a tourniquet, and both of us we're performing combat lifesaver and salve buddy care on this soldier, trying to stop the bleeding. And probably the longest 12 minutes of my life, the fire department finally showed up, and they took them away. And it was very rapid how the Office of Special Investigations was out there almost immediately, and the vice commander of the base was out there immediately, and the general came to our shop. And for the next month or so, we were under investigation. You know, was this negligence? Was this criminal action? What happened? How did this even happen? Because we were in a bunker, and we were behind a blast wall, and we had placed the shots where they were supposed to be. After a month-long safety investigation and another month waiting for their report, we finally learned that we had done what we were supposed to, but the publications that we'd been given and the range site plan that we'd been given and the place where we had been told to stand and the place where we had been told to put the munitions, they were all wrong. They were all technically wrong, even though they had been signed off and approved by the weapon safety on the base and the Department of Defense Explosive Safety Board and a 4-star general. And they had been that way since we had taken over the base in 2003. So even though the loss of life was tragic and it was traumatic, there was at least some comfort in knowing that we could move forward. And I had joined the military not to take life, but to save it. That's why I did the job Explosive Ordnance Disposal. That's why I, you know, walked down to the IEDs instead of setting them, because I was very conscious of the loss of innocent life, and improvised explosive devices are an indiscriminate enemy that can destroy the lives of civilians as much as they can the lives of military troops or adversarial forces. And we went back to work, and it had been a number of months, and we hadn't heard a single thing about it. But then another report came out for the next of kin, which was done for a different purpose. The first investigation was done for the purposes of the EOD community and safety, and the next report was a non-classified report only for the next of kin. And that report came to a completely different conclusion and determined that we were at fault. So for the next 3.5 years, I faced charges of manslaughter and negligent homicide and dereliction of duty and a number of other charges. And I couldn't afford an attorney, so I was appointed area defense counsel. And for 3.5 long years, as I, you know, battled this anxiety and what's going to happen and what about my family and what about my future, these attorneys just fought for me and fought for me. And ultimately, the charges were dismissed not once, but twice. And my attorneys encouraged me to go to law school. So I did. And the first week that I was in law school, and I had gone straight from the military into law school, the very first week, a civil rights lawyer that I had never heard of, named Brian Stevenson, was giving an appearance at our school. And he's the attorney, I learned since then, who was responsible for arguing the case that made executing juveniles unconstitutional, and a number of other, you know, fantastic civil rights cases fighting for the poor and those who could not afford representation and the most despised in our society. And I had gone into law school wanting to pay it forward, knowing that I wanted to do indigent defense because I couldn't afford my own representation and my life was virtually saved by my attorneys who would fight for me. But as soon as I heard him talk, as soon as I heard him address directly, you know, the guilt that I've been carrying around, that we are not the worst thing that we have ever done, that all of us are more than the worst thing that we have ever done, I knew I wanted to be that kind of attorney. And since that moment, the first week in law school, that's what I set my sight on. And right after law school, I came down here to Houston, and now that's what I do.
That is an amazing story. I touches on so many levels. You know, it's the death of a young man. It's the death of somebody right next to you. It's following what you're supposed to do and something goes wrong. And then the trauma of the airman's family in trying to bring an investigation back to give them a reason for this, mm-hmm. which as a parent I can understand, but sometimes Absolutely. There's not a reason for something.
Right. And I have nothing but the most profound empathy and heartache for that family. And there's no way that I can ever bring that life back that was taken. And even now, years later, I don't know. It's hard for me to assess my own culpability, if you will. It's impossible for me, being in the position that I was in, to be objective and to view it objectively. All I can do is look at it and say, yeah, I definitely feel their pain, and definitely acknowledge, you know, I don't feel it. Let me correct that. I don't feel it because I will never know what it's like to feel what they feel. But I can definitely acknowledge that they have a great amount of pain and they deserve and should have answers. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. And it's, of course, it's always interesting to go back and say a morale-boosting program blowing up bombs. you know, it's like boys and their toys. that's a very moving story that I think affected many people. And I think you really had to relive that moment over and over again.
All over those years. And over and over.
Yeah. And I guess that gave you empathy towards people who needed representation.
It changed my perspective on everything a lot. It changed my perspective on more. I mean, I had already done 3 deployments prior to that one. Had been attached to infantry units and special forces units and the French Foreign Legion for a deployment, and had done a lot of operations, but it's different when you feel responsible for a teammate, someone you're supposed to be protecting. And certainly, yeah, it was difficult to deal with all of it. And it still is. But yeah, I think it definitely increased my empathy and perspective, and it caused me to consciously reevaluate everything, even now, to make a conscious and intentional effort to see things from more points of view than just my own.
Yeah, that's remarkable. So, Jacob, you also served in Afghanistan. And when you were on the radio before, you spoke of a multitude of feelings, finding yourself in the Army, not to mention basic training in a very, very cold state far away from the weather of Texas, going to Afghanistan, where you began to realize what it was like to face a strategic enemy, and then finally coming back home. Can you tell us a little about your experience returning to civilian life?
Well, leaving the military was never my choice. I was a truck driver. I was an ADA mic in the Army. And there was an incident on our way to Bagram with my vehicle. And I was medevaced back to the States. Now, I went through a lot of therapy, both individual and group, PTSD, mindfulness. I hate the word mindfulness because it doesn't work for me. My mind doesn't shut off. But then after I had my knee surgery, I was told by my company, 360th Transportation, that we were disbanding. And that they were sending everybody, you know, other places. Some were going to Fort Drum in New York. Some were going to Riley. Some were going to Korea. And because I just had knee surgery, they're like, you're going to stay in Colorado, and we're going to move you to 32nd Transportation. Now, they were our rivals on our post. That's the group we didn't get along with. We badmouthed, you know, like a brother rivalry. Well, I found out 32nd was deploying in 3 months later. So I didn't care about the rivalry. I wanted to jump back on that deployment. I talked to my wife, and we agreed, deploy. My biggest thing was I didn't finish my first deployment. I wanted to finish one. And I was about a month away from deploying when I got pulled into a doctor's office. And he asked me what I was planning to do in the future. I told him my plans. I was going to deploy in a month. I was going to go to the promotion board in downrange. It's a little easier. It's a little bit more relaxed on the questions than the promotion board. I was going to come back E5 as a sergeant, go green to gold, which means I'm still in the military, but all I'm doing is going to school of my choice. and then I was going to become an officer. That was my overall plan. I was going to do 20, if not more. And as I told him this, he looked at me and he said, well, not only are you not deploying, you're out of the military and out of a job in 9 months. I'm med boarding you. Everything at that time just crashed down on me. I'm thinking of my family. I'm thinking of my wife. I'm thinking about my plans. I'm thinking about, wait a second, I didn't even make my contract out. And you're telling me I'm done and this is how you're going to do it? Just, oh, yeah, you're out in 9 months. So I retained an attorney and I was going to fight it. But the one thing you learn while serving in the military is if the government wants something, they'll find a way. And they wanted me out. So Shay and I decided to take the benefits. And my last day of service was September the 12th of 2013. I was extremely bitter for about 6 months afterwards. Bitter with the doctor, bitter at the Army, bitter at myself. And I first started at U of H downtown in the spring of 2014. At this time, I had connected with the student veterans organization that University of Houston had downtown. I also went to events that Lone Star Veterans Association here in Houston, how they had. And I started understanding I was not alone when I started talking to other people and their problems. So with this epiphany, I started working more with the SVO and ended up becoming the president of the student veterans organization. And I started the first U of H downtown haunted house. So I felt I gained a lot of knowledge from friends and dealing with the VA on my own. Because the VA doesn't give information out. If you find it, they'll give you the benefits, but you've got to hunt it down and find it. So I truly used these groups to let other veterans know, hey, this is what you need to do. These are who you need to go talk to. And I really wanted to help them cut the red tape that I had to cut. And then, of course, there were my professors. And Hank, I have to thank you for everything you've done for me, not only in my education, my future career, but also my personal life. You're my professor, my mentor, my friend. Without you, I would have never realized this dream of radio. And Hankonites, if you ever have somebody you truly respect, take their advice, because you never know where it'll get you.
That's a wonderful story. And that's a wonderful story about our mentor, Hank. I really appreciate that. So, the two of y'all experienced difficult times in the Army in different ways, but career changing. What was it like to transition back to civilian life? I mean, you talked about having been bitter.
I'm still trying to, even at school, I've now been conditioned to move with a purpose. No lollygag. Get where you need to go. Do what you need to do. Set up. If you've got time after you set up, great. But get where you're going, all that. So even at the school, when I'm walking behind people and they're walking slow, it aggravates me. It's like, move on. Stop looking at your phone. Get to your classroom. If it's not open, stand out the hall and look at your phone. But I'm trying to move. So, Matthew, I don't know if it's the same thing with you, but that's one big thing is just, I'm this tactful person. I got to be on time. I got to be where I need to be.
I think for me, it's almost the opposite. It's been difficult to transition in that I had been conditioned to move with a purpose and to get things done on time and to do this and to do that and to move in that way and to get annoyed with people in front of us. And hey, I got places to be, things to do, you know. But then once I got out, and probably even a little bit before that, I became just much more, you know what, like, life is too short for me to get upset at the person who's slow in front of me. And life is too short to be rushing something, to not get it done right the first time, to make a mistake that could, you know, have much bigger consequences than being late. And I just started making it much more of a point to pay attention to the time that I was in. And I also don't like the term mindfulness because, like, my mind doesn't shut off either. It's just like, you know, constantly moving to the point that I can't even stand it sometimes. But I think it changed me in a way that now I'm very much more like, I'm with the person that I'm with and I'm doing the thing that I'm doing. And when I'm done with this, then I'll get on to the next thing. And so I'm late all the time now, and that's something that like it bothers me, and I'm chronically tardy. But I've almost gone like the other way, and have had trouble adjusting to like
my wife wishes you know. I had gone your way, because we're usually at family events. We're usually like 15-20 minutes early, because in my clock I'm running late.
I'm reliable, but I'm reliably late.
Oh, gosh, that was fun to listen to. Okay, everybody, we are here on So What's Your Story, broadcast live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. at KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and let's not forget, live streaming from KPFT.org. Yes, all the way to the space station. We look forward to our weekly show and the opportunity to be an important part of the Houston storytelling scene. I know my previous co-hosts have mentioned it, but I would like to say again that we all enjoyed seeing several of our co-hosts and many of our guests at the Moss Grand Slam. I know that even though we are the only live radio storytelling show, there are other storytelling venues in our community. So, Nicole and Tatiana.
Oh,
Tatiana. Oh, my God. You know, you guys out there in Radio Land, I think it took me 6 months to learn to pronounce Nicole's last name. It is not Nicole.
It's my middle name.
But it's not Nicole Rocherland, which is a nice Texan pronunciation.
Rocherland. Did I get that?
Rocherland. She's from Chicago. It's Rocherland. And now I'm trying to do Tatiana in a different way, but I apologize.
Okay, Mary.
So, back to the topic. Can you tell us about some of the storytelling venues?
Yes, I can. First, let me say something about our show. If you don't have a radio, it's no excuse for missing it, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org or Facebook Live on our So What's Your Story Facebook page. But yes, there are some other important storytelling venues in and around town. Let's start with the Houston Storytellers Guild. Join them, because this is the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. Just get to their monthly story swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset. Go to their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org, for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio program.
Oh, yes. And let's emphasize that. You can listen to our old shows over and over again. And hopefully, I am not the only one who does that. I mean, I'm having a slow, bad time at work, and it's like, I'm putting on a story, man, in the background. Let me find one that I like. So remember, you can get those past shows at HoustonStorytellers.org. Okay, sorry, I interrupted. But I just love listening to the oldies but goodies. So please continue.
Well, we also post on our YouTube channel, so check out our program clips there as well. And tell us what you think about our shows, or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. Also, we will respond to your messages, and we have been getting them, so keep them coming. And, you know, please be sure to share our page with your friends and your foes and your enemies and your lovers. We have some great stories for you to listen to, and we'd love it if you'd like us before you leave. But we also don't want to miss our good friends at the Mob. That's at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month. And since we had a Grand Slam this month, and a big shout out to all of you who told the stories there, the Story Slam has moved from its usual spot on the second Tuesday of the month to May 22nd. And the theme is going to be ego, like Beyonce. She's saying, I got a big ego. But anyways, while in the common vernacular, we think of ego as self-esteem. To early psychoanalyst and present-day traditionalist, it is the part of the mind that meditates between the conscious and the unconscious, and is responsible for reality testing and a sense of personal identity. So go for it, storytellers. Now, back to the calendar. The Moth will be returning to its regular spot in June, which is the second Tuesday of the month.
Okay. So, ladies, you want to tell us what's happening next Wednesday at 8 p.m.?
I think she wants us
to. KPFT.org? KPFT 90.1 or KPFT.org? That's close.
Yeah, I think you just want to, you know, toot your own horn, Mary.
Yeah.
But I'll be happy, because
thank you.
Women rule, and we have been missing you. And, Mary, you will be back with us again next week. That is right, everybody. Miss Mary herself, Mary E is what I like to call her since I'm from Chicago, is hosting another show, and this one on mental health or mental hygiene, as she might like to call it. Mary, do you have any guests that you want to tell us about?
Oh, yes, yes. And thank you, Nicole, for...
Mary E.
For that introduction, yes. And Mary E is, but there are a lot of Marys. When I go into Starbucks and they say, what's your name? My first question is, have you had a Mary in line already? If not, it's okay. I'll give it to you. Okay, we're going to have Dr. Michael Winters. He's a local psychotherapist, and he's been a previous guest on our show. And then two of our other co-hosts, Dr. Warren Holloman, also a psychotherapist, and Dr. Hank Rubicek. So please tune in and sync up with us next week. The show has a lot of personal importance to me, as you will hear next Wednesday. Now, I don't often, or I don't think I have ever done two shows in a row. These two just happened, so tune in next week and find out all about it. So guys, I think we're up for some more stories, and I know you have some more in you. So Matthew, let's go to you getting out of the armed forces and moving on. I know that while you were at law school in Wisconsin, you worked with the Innocence Project. Can you tell us a little bit, explain a story that will explain what that is?
Sure. You know, this actually kind of almost relates back to the point that we were talking about, you know, rushing or not rushing. So Innocence Project cases take a long time. Oftentimes, these are inmates who have exhausted their appeals, and their only options left are almost Hail Marys. And, you know, we all carry a caseload, and many classes go by where students don't get that moment where they walk someone out of prison or where they get an exoneration. We all see it on the news where someone walks out of jail smiling, but it's easy to forget that, you know, they spent decades in there many times without having justice. And that means that the true perpetrator was out on the streets, and it also means that an innocent person was locked up. In one of our cases, it looked pretty hopeless, and DNA could not exclude him. At the time of the crime, he was accused of some horrible crimes, and DNA could not exclude him, and eyewitnesses put him at the scene. But we believed in his innocence, and his family believed in his innocence, and we had the DNA evidence tested again, and it turned out that it was impossible for him to have committed the crime. He was conclusively excluded for what he did. So even though for 24 years he had been locked up, writing letters to everybody, writing letters to the DA, writing letters to the Attorney General, and to, you know, any attorney who would listen, telling them that he was innocent. You know, this man had lost his mother while he was incarcerated. He had lost his fiance. You know, he had lost everything in his entire adult life, from when he was in his young 20s until 24 years later. And finally, he walked out of prison a free man, exonerated. And the first place we took him was to a Target to get some clothes, because he had no clothes. He had only been wearing prison garb, and he had no money. We had to next take him to a bank so that he could get set up with an account at least. And, you know, they wouldn't take his prison ID. Didn't even have an ID. There are so many barriers to reentry. But we were walking out of that Target, it started raining, and we all being his team of the attorney and the law students that were on the team, you know, started kind of jogging to get back to the car as quickly as we could. And he just stopped right in the middle of the parking lot and looked up to the sky and spread his hands out. And we turned around, and he had the biggest smile on his face. And it wasn't just because he was free, but because he hadn't felt rain in 24 years. And that's what he wanted to stop and wait for. And it was a really powerful moment. And when I went back to school, we had been given drawing assignments in a drawing class that I took with a bunch of undergraduates. And that's the first picture that I drew in one of our free writing assignments, was my memory of him standing there with his arms outspread in front of that Target retail store, just so he could feel the rain after 24 years.
You've brought tears to my eyes. That's an amazing... Rain has a special meaning for me because I grew up in a semi-arid area. And so whenever it rained, I'd go outside to listen to the rainfall. And to think that I might not have heard it for 24 years is hard to encompass. And also, I have to say, I hate being accused of something that I did not do. I feel like a 2-year-old throwing a tantrum. No. And to be closed up in 4 cement walls, trying. So I'm very excited that the DNA technology has brought a new level of accuracy to crime solving. As long as you do it correctly. I'm a pathologist, so I know that there can be...
Right. It's not infallible, as we would like to think. But we are making advances, and I think that's important that we continue to make those advances in not just DNA testing, but in all the forensic sciences.
Oh, I definitely think so. I actually did a month of forensic pathology, and it was astonishing. Some of the crimes were astonishing. Realizing the suicide rates among young men in their 20s, was astonishing. Seeing a very brutal rape murder. And at first when I went, I thought, oh, this is actually really exciting. It's crime solving, it's solving a puzzle, and you're really helping the community. And by the end of the month, I was walking around the block one time, and I'd go out for my little constitutional at sundown, and some man was putting some bag into his trunk. And I just thought to myself, oh, my God, he's murdered somebody. He's stuffing them in the trunk. And our eyes met, and I said, oh, my God, and now he's seen me see him. And I ran back home, and I said to my husband, I think a man down the street murdered his wife and is stuffing her in his trunk. And he said, What are you talking about? He said, you know, dead bodies are pretty heavy. I just don't think that happened. So I gave up on it, but it's yeah, quite interesting.
I don't blame
science.
You. I don't blame you. It's heavy work, and anybody, whether it be law enforcement or people on the defense side or forensic examiners or victim advocates, they all carry around a lot of trauma that we don't see day in
yes.
and day out. So,
yes.
You know, I don't blame you for taking a different road. Because it's heavy dealing with crime day in and day out.
It is. I don't know if you remember, there was a movie called The Wolfen.
Mm-mm.
Anyway, the Wolfen were these mythical creatures that come out and they eat people. And as one shaman says to an investigator in New York, oh, they eat your unwanted, they eat your homeless, they eat your... And anyway, I would descend down these stairs down into the forensic... lab in Philadelphia, and I thought, I feel like I'm descending into the world of the Wolfen. But you know what, guys? We promised you some difficult stories, and I think we've listened to them, and I thank my guests for taking the time out and to tell us those and reliving difficult moments. But I promised you that Jacob would tell us a closing story, and that you will have a warm and redemptive feeling for this show after hearing it. And I have to confess, I am probably the second most important leaker in my family. You know, there's a go-to person when you want everybody to know that you broke up with your you know, spouse, but or your
mm-hmm.
person. But you don't want to have to call everybody and tell them, so you go find the leaker.
Yep,
okay,
nope.
I'm not number one. But I'm definitely number two. But I'm going to let Jacob take the lead here. So this will be a surprise closer.
All right. So when I got out of the military and I got home and I started, you know, going through the VA and working my process and trying to get into the VA hospital, I found out that I qualified for a service dog. Now, my wife and I, we live in a condo that doesn't allow animals. So it was imperative that I get paperwork from my doctors in order to let an animal in. And as I was dealing with the painful bureaucratic process of the VA, my wife and I were visiting different animal shelters. As I wanted a rescue dog because I didn't want to pay a breeder, for one, I didn't have the money, but then other, if I'm getting a dog to help me, why not help the dog back too? I don't believe in kill shelters or anything, so I wanted a rescue dog. But I also wanted a bully breed. I love pit bulls for their fit look, their loving personality, and how smart they are. I also truly believe that pit bulls are the most misunderstood dog breed. I truly believe it's how they're trained, not how they naturally are. They're not naturally aggressive dogs. They used to be called babysitter dogs because they could be left with little kids and protect them. It's how they were trained to be aggressive. For weeks, I would leave shelters disappointed, either because the true dog of my choice wasn't there or my paperwork still hadn't cleared yet. I had seen a lot of great dogs that I would have loved to have. Our friend Mary Rafferty would go with us to every shelter we went to, and she would be that level head saying, "Are you sure that's the dog you want?" As I would go outside to play with the dog of my choice at that moment, that question rang in my head. Are you sure that's the dog you want? And then I would decide no, it was not, and feel somewhat rejected. There were a few times at the SPCA I did fall in like with some of the dogs. Like there was a beautiful, gorgeous terrier mix that I was playing fetch with. His name was Otto. Of course, that was his shelter name. We don't know what his real name was. And the question not only played in my head, but Mary herself said it again. Are you sure that's the dog you want? And sadly, this time I said yes, but I still yet to have the paperwork. Now, it had already been 4.5 months since I requested the paperwork from my doctor. So at this moment in time, I'm starting to get upset with the whole process, with going to the shelters, with having to work with the doctors at the VA. I was just ready for my service dog. When my wife said, "Babe, we can check back next weekend. Hopefully you get your paperwork and the dog will still be here." Well, that week I spent 2 full days at the VA waiting and inquiring about my paperwork. Halfway through the third day, I finally got my paperwork. I called my wife and texted Mary at that very moment in time, and I said, "We're going dog shopping and we're bringing one home this time." So on August the 14th of 2016, 3 days before me and my wife's 5th wedding anniversary, by the way, we went to the SPCA, and the dog I fell in like with was gone. At the moment, my heart was too. Mary said we should go to lunch and think about where to go to next. At lunch, I said I wanted to go to BARC, which is the Houston's animal shelter. It's actually the city of Houston's animal shelter. Mary didn't want to go because she had bad experiences every time she had gone in the past. I assured her that they had done renovations to the ground and it was gorgeous, and we wanted her present because she had been there for the past month. She agreed, and off to BARC we went. The first thing my wife and I did was look at the puppies. And let me tell you, the puppy pen was beautiful. But again, all the puppies that I wanted were already called for adoption. So as we started to walk where the big dog kennels were, my wife stopped dead in her tracks, staring at a 1-week-old black lab. At this very moment, I saw my vision of having a pit bull starting to fade away. We were told we couldn't take the dog home that day because it needed shots and tests. It had just come in. After talking to the missus, I gave in and decided, okay. It wouldn't have been my first choice, but it fell in my parameters. Age-wise, it was young enough to teach, but I would have to deal with barking, house training, etc. I was looking for more like a dog 1 to 3. It was teachable, but it wasn't old enough to have a lot of bad habits. And seeing how this dog was going to go everywhere with me, it had to fall into my guidelines. As we were waiting for them to do what they needed to do with the puppy, that single most annoying question popped back into my head. Are you sure this is the dog you want? It was not. I started to make my way to the bigger dogs. I walked into the first kennel onto the right aisle. I wasn't impressed. But as I started walking up the aisle leading back towards the exit, I saw this orange and white American Staffordshire Terrier staring at me through the fence, googly eyes, puppy eyes, trying to do whatever he could to stick his tongue out far enough to give me a kiss. Now, I need to tell you, I've only fell in love at first sight twice. And that was when I saw my wife, and that was when I saw my dog Bradley. I asked the attendant in the kennel if I could take him for a walk, And as we were walking out of the room, Mary and my wife were walking out of another room. Then my wife gave me the look that every man should know. The, you're going to be sleeping on the couch if you make this decision look. As I was walking in, the infamous question came back into my head. Are you sure this is the dog you want? Well, ladies and gentlemen, this was the last time I ever had to hear that question until tonight. Because I made that choice. And within 2 hours, my wife was not only talking to me, but loving up on Bradley Noel Reiner. And yes, I was able to sleep in the bed that night. Even with all the dogs I had seen and interacted with, I never would have felt as complete as I do with my Bradley. I love my wife. She gives me the support and love I need. But Brad fills holes that Shay can't fill. He helps me with knees that Shay cannot, helping me up the stairs if my knees are acting up that day, helping me off the ground because I decided to sit Indian style. And most importantly, he was an ear that was always open and a heart filled with the love that never comes with judgments.
Oh, that's beautiful. So beautiful. I have always had this feeling about pets that they're magical.
Yes.
So Winnie the Pooh was one of my favorite books that
so
I read.
So was mine.
Ah.
So was mine.
And you know what? I was very lucky at a book show in New York. While I was living there, they actually had Christopher Milne's original stuffed animals. So I got to see Eeyore and Tigger and
Piglet.
Yes, all of them. And so as I've had my own pets, and as Christopher Milne's toys each had different personalities, mm-hmm. my pets are magical. They're like my stuffed animal that came to life with its own personality. That's just how I see them. And I love them. But it's wonderful, though, I think, on another level, to have a dog who is connected to you as a service dog, yes. as opposed to a pet.
Yes, and that was the one big thing, is my parents always wanted to call Bradley my pet. And finally, I kind of went off on him one day. I said, no, he's not my pet. He's my companion. He may be a dog, but he's my best friend. When my wife isn't there, he's my support. And that's the big thing that people need to separate, is when you see a dog with a service dog vest on and says, do not touch or do not distract, understand that that's not a pet for that guy. And they're just putting it on because they want to walk around. They have a need. And when you distract the dog, if something were to happen and he wasn't able to fill that need, it would actually be on that person that distracted the dog. If I were to get injured or something were to happen to me and Bradley couldn't lift me up or something, it would fall on that person that distracted him. Because when they're working.
Right. And as you and I were talking before the show, you told me there's a difference between a service dog and a therapy dog.
There is. A service dog comes with actual disability needs, whether it be visitation for the blind or mobility, like for me, walking downstairs, walking upstairs, he takes care of that mobility. Then also with service dogs, there's that emotional for PTSD. It's the dog will get in the middle of a person if he sees the person getting agitated at someone else or something. They'll separate it. Then there's emotional dogs. Now, emotional dogs are still somewhat kind of the same as a PTSD service dog, but in a way where it's more of a soothing type animal, where they look at it to soothe their anxiety. Not to stop the anxiety, but to soothe the anxiety so you can get past an anxiety attack or a panic attack. And then also the difference is a service dog can go into any building a human can. Without question, you don't have to talk about your disability, which you legally can't be asked anyway because it goes against the HIPAA. But an emotional dog doesn't have the same rights. So they can still fly on airplanes. Mind you, an emotional dog, not an emotional peacock okay? but they can go on. But they may not be allowed into movie theaters or into restaurants or into museums because they're not taking care of an actual disability need at that moment in time.
I get that. I get that. I guess I've read about service dogs in the context of people who have epilepsy.
Yes.
And the dogs can sense that the epileptic yes. fit is going to happen.
And then also, if it is happening, the dog, some dogs are trained to slide under the head.
Oh, to make sure
to
that
lift
you don't,
the head up so you don't swallow your yeah. tongue or stuff like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. We are getting close to the end of a really wonderful hour. I want to thank my storytellers again for opening up your hearts to us. And what I like to do at the end of my show is give my storytellers a chance to say something to somebody in Radioland. So, Matthew, want to say something?
Well, of course. Well, first, I've got to give a shout-out to my wife and three daughters. I love all those girls, Monica, and she's been with me 15 years plus now, and my daughters Madeline, Lillian, and Zoe, and also my co-editors at a literary journal that I run online called The Wrath-Bearing Tree. We publish stories, fiction, and essays on military, social, economic, all kinds of societal violence, taking kind of like a look at that and how it affects all of us. That's wrathbearingtree.com, wrath-bearingtree.com. Take it from the line of a T.S. Eliot poem. So thanks to all of those co-editors.
Oh, thank you. And Jacob?
I'd like to say thank you to my wife who supports me in everything I do. Thank my parents. And then I know I've done it already, but I would like to thank Dr. Hank Rubicek again for everything he's done for me. And I want to say thank you for So What's Your Story to all of y'all hosts, you, Greg, Warren, everybody. If it wasn't for y'all, I wouldn't be at Sports Radio 610 fulfilling my dream of talking for 4 hours straight.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. So don't you dare move, listeners, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are ready in the wings to share their cool classics with you. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD2 stream.